The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
What is your vision like? How clearly do you see? Today, we're examining the resurrection of Jesus. Who were the first eyewitnesses to Jesus' resurrection? What did they see? And does their testimony persuade you? Welcome to the City Bible Forum this lunchtime. My name is Tor Lu. Now, in your handouts, which you should have received on your way in, we've got blank slips of paper. And these are for you to ask the hard questions. As you hear today's talk, examine the evidence. Does it persuade you? If not, why not? Jot down your comments and your questions as we investigate this question of the resurrection of Jesus. We'll turn now to consider the testimony of the Bible in John chapter 20, beginning at verse 1. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and said, "They've taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they've put him." Jumping to verse 11, "Now Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. They asked her, 'Woman, why are you crying?' 'They've taken my Lord away,' she said, 'and I don't know where they've put him.' At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she didn't realize that it was Jesus. He asked her, 'Woman, why are you crying? Who is it that you're looking for?' Thinking he was the gardener, she said, 'Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've put him, and I'll get him.' Jesus said to her, 'Mary.' She turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, 'Rabboni,' which means 'teacher.' Jesus said, 'Don't hold on to me, for I've yet ascended to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I'm ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God.' Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, 'I've seen the Lord,' and she told them that he had said these things to her. On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together, with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, 'Peace be with you.' After he said this, he showed them his hands and side. The disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord." And skipping to verse 24. "Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, 'We've seen the Lord.' But he said to them, 'Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe.'"
Well, good afternoon. Some of you remember a boxer called Muhammad Ali. He certainly wasn't the world's, at the end of the century's best boxer, but he was a magnificent boxer. And he joined a sort of an Islamic group, a very distinctively American one, but he was interviewed some years after that, and the interviewer said to him, "Muhammad, if you could be at any place in the world and at any moment in human history, where and when would you like to be?" It's a fascinating question. You might like to play with that if a dinner party becomes boring or something like that sometime. Muhammad Ali gave a very interesting answer, particularly for a guy of his particular religious persuasion. He said, "I'd like to be outside the tomb of Jesus on Easter Sunday morning to see what really happened. Now that's intriguing when you think of the things, the great moments in Muhammad's life that he might have wanted to be. But it's interesting to think, I wonder why Muhammad Ali chose outside Jesus' tomb on Easter Sunday morning. A slightly different character who died long before Muhammad Ali became famous, a very well-known English 20th century philosopher, C.E.M. Jode, was asked if he could meet one person in history and ask them one question, who and what would be the question? And Jode answered this. The professor said, I would like to meet Jesus Christ and I would like to ask him the most important question in all the world. Did you or did you not rise from the dead? The boxer, the philosopher. I think they've both shown an insight that many of us may not as yet see. Because in terms of the resurrection of Jesus, a number of times Jesus gets asked by his contemporaries to give them proof, evidence, a reason to believe that he is who he says he is. And both times in John 2 and Matthew 12, he ties it back to the resurrection or forward to the resurrection. And he says, if that happens, there's my proof. So in terms of the identity of Jesus, Jesus ties the question to his own coming death and then subsequent resurrection. Deaths are everyday events, aren't they? But resurrection's not quite so. And secondly, I think, the question of the resurrection of Jesus. If it's possible that someone has actually gone into the belly of the beast of death, as you will, and everyone you love will or has, and torn their way out, and has actually overpowered death, that is a joyful and a relevant bit of information to know about someone. But see, you probably ask yourself, why on earth did the Christians not do what everyone else has done when their great teacher, prophet, leader has died and just build them a decent tomb or with Buddha, cremate him and then spread his ashes to many, many, many sacred places in various parts of Asia? Why did they have the silly and unique idea that their leader didn't stay dead? Moses stayed dead, Muhammad stayed dead, Buddha stayed dead, Confucius stayed dead, Zoroaster stayed dead. We sometimes think, well, that's just what religious people do because we grew up, or some of us grew up, you know, in sort of influenced cultures by this belief. But it's worthwhile to think, why would they believe this somewhat silly belief? It wasn't a popular belief in the ancient world. When Christianity hit Greece and first tried to explain itself in Athens, the great city of learning and democracy and the arts, as they talked about God and that, the Greeks were happy. When they got to the resurrection, they mocked them. The Greeks have no interest in resurrection. I mean, it's a silly belief, not popular, not believed in then. The one thing ancient people knew is that when you're dead, you're dead. They didn't have these fancy, where you know, the sort of things you see. I've been watching Lost. I'm always about 10 years behind television programs. I want to wait until we see if they're good. So I've been watching Lost because one of my daughters is right into it. And about every second person who dies in Lost gets brought back. Death is a very temporary experience. If they're drowned, they get punched in the chest a few times and water comes up and up they come. It's just remarkable how few of them stay dead. But in the ancient world, when you're dead, you're dead. And particularly when you've been crucified by the Romans. We know of no one, although the Romans killed tens if not hundreds of thousands of people through crucifixion, there is not the slightest echo of anyone who came down from those crosses only half dead, or mostly dead, or having fallen into a dozy sleep from which they woke up when they were sort of dumped in a cool cave, all that sort of nonsense. So it's very clear Jesus is dead. I don't know of any historian in the last 30 or so years who's tried to argue for the non-death of Jesus. It's just a self-evidently silly belief to those who know about the way in which Romans killed. So we're dealing with this very peculiar belief, which, although it is peculiar both then and now, continues to convince highly educated and well-informed people. Just two examples. Francis Collins, one of the world's leading scientists, finished the Human Genome Program. Big believer in the fact that Jesus walked out of the tomb alive. In spite of his career as a professional biologist. Edwin Judge, an Australian, one of the world's leading ancient historians, firmly convinced that this is a real event. Well, how come? What was it that convinced the first Christians of this somewhat silly belief that Jesus didn't stay dead? Well, if you have a look at the text you've got there, we don't have time. We've played with this in the past, that I think there's very good evidence to take John seriously as an eyewitness and honest writer. And I think you'll see things in this which will indicate again the man's honesty. So you can see in verse 1, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary went to the tomb and saw the stone had removed from the entrance. So she sees the tomb has been messed around with, it's been interfered with, and she goes, the body's missing? Well, resurrection is the obvious thing to believe, isn't it? Missing body, resurrection. It's obvious, isn't it? No, because this is a real live person. She runs back to Simon Peter and the other disciples, all locked up in a room, and she says, he is risen. No, there is them, verse, the end of paragraph 1. They've taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they've put him. Missing body? Not, oh, resurrection. Right? They're not idiots, these people. I mean, there's this terrible chronological snobbery that people in some cultures think that anyone who lived back there was a fool. They'd believe anything. They're often more in touch with the grim realities of life than some of us are. She just assumed that the filthy rats who'd killed Jesus, and not just killed him, but chosen the way of death, which is the most humiliating and the most shameful, reserved only for scum, that they've now come and desecrated his grave, continuing their vendetta against him. So that's what she thinks. And she'll say that three times. She says it to the disciples. In verse 13, she says it to the angels. And then in verse 15, she says it to Jesus before she realizes who it is. That's her inference to the best explanation, to use a fine phrase from modern science. She has some information. The body's gone. She has an inference. She infers. It's the obvious. Some filthy rat had desecrated his grave. Well, that's not going to give birth to some worldwide transforming movement, is it? Well, let's look at step 2. Where Mary discovers that she is wonderfully wrong. Isn't it good sometimes to discover you're wrong, right? Sometimes we'd rather die than discover we're wrong, but every now and then it's great to be wrong. Well, Mary is very convinced that someone has stolen the body. She looks in at one stage into the grave. She sees the angels. I'm not going to talk much about angels, but if ever there was a place where God might send angels, the resurrection of his son might just be the place, I reckon. The Bible doesn't think angels are floating around all over the place, regularly being seen. You've been ripped off if you haven't met 10 by the time you're 20. It's not talking like that, but, you know, at the birth of God's son and the resurrection of his son, if there are angels, that's where they may just turn up, I think. Not at my birthday. They seem to have ignored me. But these angels are there. They say, woman, why are you crying? They know this is a day of joy. It's the same question Jesus asked. You know, this is not a day for crying, really. This is a happy day, but not yet. Why are you crying? They have taken away the Lord. She turns away from the tomb and she sees Jesus standing there, but she kind of doesn't recognize it as Jesus. Now, friends, this is one of the really helpful things that the Gospels regularly tell us. Historians speak about what they call a criteria of embarrassment. That is, if a source tells you something that actually embarrasses or weakens the case that they're arguing, that sort of stands in their favour as a mark of honesty. Does that make sense? So if I'm a great fan of Julia Gillard, and I tell you she lied about her notes on that opening address, and I've got a picture indicating it, you're liable to believe it if I'm a fan of Julia and I don't tell a story against her. Whereas if I'm some filthy Liberal Party supporter, you might think, of course, you'd say the poor woman's lying. But these guys, a lot of the Gospels will have Luke and Matthew and John will all have accounts where people meet the resurrected Jesus, but don't work out it's him first off. Now, with Mary, we're greatly helped by verse 18, where it says she turned towards him. So she's obviously upset, crying her eyes out. The last person in the world she's expecting to see is Jesus. And she hasn't got her face towards him. But she sees him. He's in the garden where the tomb was. It's early in the morning. Who hangs around gardens early in the morning? Well, gardeners hang around gardens early in the morning. So she presumes him to be the gardener, asks him her question again. If you've taken him, tell me where you put him. He answers her, and Tor read this. Well, this is one of the hardest verses to read, I think. Verse 16. Jesus said to her, Mary. And there was something in the tone of his voice, in the timbre of his voice, the fact of his voice, that she immediately recognized the voice. voice is actually one of the most defining marks of a person. In fact, they've done studies that indicate if you just hear a voice, you're better able to work out if the person is telling you the truth or lying than if you see the whole person. Anyhow, she hears the voice of Jesus, Mary. She turned towards him and cries out in Aramaic, obviously delighted, Rabboni, my teacher. And then from what Jesus says in the next verse, do not hold on to me. Literally in the Greek it says, cease holding me. She's obviously presumably fallen at his feet, but may not have. Whatever it is, Mary has recognized it's Jesus and she's grabbed him. Right? She is not letting him get away. Right, this is what you do when someone who you love and have lost suddenly turns up. So Jesus said, let go for the time being. We're not going back to the way it was. It's a different era. But nonetheless, Mary is the first one to see Jesus. She's wonderfully wrong, isn't she? She knew the body had gone. She presumed, as you would, that something ordinary and human and ugly had happened, but discovers he's alive. Verse 18, she rushes back to the disciples. The second time she's been to the disciples this morning, and she says, I have seen the Lord. And she told them that he had said these things to her. Now, one of the interesting things here, and this is a helpful thing about Christianity, Christianity has rightly been described for decades, if not longer. Christianity is not views, but it's news. Have you heard that before? It's not views about God. Christianity is not a package of ideas. Many religions are. It's a package of ideas about God that comes through some enlightened person. Christianity isn't that. It's not views. It's fundamentally news. Something has happened in human history. So Mary doesn't come back and say, I see that good ultimately triumphs over evil. Life triumphs over death. It's not that at all. It's, I've seen him. It's news of something that's happened that she has experienced. And if the difficulty of sometimes the disciples not recognizing Jesus first time they see him is one of those helpful, embarrassing moments, and I don't know how to stress this, I've been pondering this for many years and it seems to me overwhelmingly powerful. One of the things that we take for granted in the 21st century is that when Matthew, Mark, Luke and John tell the story of the resurrection, the first and the key witnesses are women. Now we say, well, of course. Nah. In the Roman culture, and even more so in the Jewish culture, women could not bear witness in court. One of the writers from the time, Josephus, says, because of the weakness and the temerity of their sex. I'm not saying that. I don't believe it. It's a kind of a cute phrase. But they just weren't allowed to bear witness because they were considered to be, by nature, unreliable. It's disgraceful, but that's what many cultures, that's the way they've, men's opinion, oh, that's what I think. Well, we never lie. We never get all emotional. But women. And yet, when you read the book of Acts, the first series of sermons by Christians, the apostles, they'll say, you guys killed him. God raised him. We saw him. We're witnesses. Now, it's fair enough in that context, but they point to themselves witnesses. What they never, ever, ever, ever say, Mary saw him, then we saw him. The women discover the empty tomb and we tagged along. Right? And when the Apostle Paul is trying to convince the Corinthians about the resurrection and he gives a series of witnesses, three crowds and three or four individuals, again, he doesn't mention the women. But when the blokes sit down to write down the account of what actually happened, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, women, 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 why? Why would they do that? It weakens. We know that even for the first 100 years, Christianity used to get mocked for this. We've got the writings of Christians defending the fact that it was women, because it was seen to be such an obviously dodgy start. It's like having your key witnesses being politicians. I love politicians, and it's not that they're all liars. I don't believe that for a second. But, you know, you wouldn't, if you were making up a story, you'd have someone more reliable, like a journalist or something like that. Someone who you know would always tell you the truth. That was a joke, sorry. But historians have been really struck by this, that when they sat down to write it, that it was the women. Now, that the if you read the different stories, some of them speak about a group of women. John tells you about Mary going. He doesn't say Mary and Mary alone. He's simply focusing on Mary. When she comes back, she says, the body's gone. We don't know where they've put him. So there's a reference there to the fact that there's more than one. You can read about the other gals who are there in the other Gospels. But it's one of the great things that Jesus chooses to first appear to a woman. He could have appeared to Peter. He could have appeared to John. He is not a misogynist pig. He appears to Mary and sends her, as the early church used to call her, as the apostle to the apostles. She is sent to tell the ones who in the end get sent. Well, there's the step two, the wonderful witnesses, the first witness in Mary. She believes he's risen because she's seen him. Well, she's telling the blokes. And you can read some of the other details of this in Luke's gospel. He'll have other details about how the blokes responded when they first heard it, which was not good. Verse 19. On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together, with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After that, he showed them his hands and his side, and the disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. So it starts off with just Mary. They've got Mary's sermon ringing in their ears. I've seen him. And here is when they see him. This is the disciples, without Judas, because he's dead, sadly, and without Thomas, as we'll learn. So 10 of them. He appears to the 10 of them. And it's worthwhile noticing what he does. In a way that he never, ever does before his resurrection, he just appears in a room that is locked. Whatever this new body is, and it's a body, you can touch it, it eats food in Luke's gospel. He has a body. It's a body that is somehow or other more malleable, more magnificent. It's what the rest of the Bible calls it's a glorified body. It's the sort of body that my friend Paul, who died last night, will get. It's a resurrection body in direct continuity with the body that we have here, and yet seeming to do, after the resurrection, Jesus will do things which he never did before that, like just turning up in locked rooms. And see what Jesus does. He shows them his hands and his side. Why does he do that? What's he doing there? He is actually giving them evidence, isn't he? So that their minds can be sure this is not a twin, which one clown suggested the whole Christian thing was based on the fact that Jesus had it's like a Gilbert and Sullivan opera, it's ridiculous. You know, that Jesus had this twin that we've got no record of in history, not an echo of until some clown comes up with in the 1980s. He had an identical twin who went missing. On the very weekend that Jesus dies, guess who shows up in Jerusalem? Yep, no, well, that's counsel of desperation, but that's one attempt to make sense of the resurrection. So it's significant that the early Gospels tell you he showed them his hands and the side where they put the spear because Jesus died quicker than the other guys on either side of him. Once you pass out, if that's what you think it is, you die in it, because the way you die on the cross is by suffocation. So if you've passed out, you know, you've got a few seconds to be got down. They stick a spear up his side, and out comes blood and water, which doctors say is indication of the body being well and truly dead. He shows them the evidence. Why? Because unlike some of the silly definitions of faith, the idea that evidence and faith are somehow the contrary, it's just not a view the Bible shares. So if people want to define faith like that, and some have, they're welcome to do it. It's just not, Jesus doesn't say, now, you should believe I rose from the dead without evidence. He doesn't do that. He says, look, it's me. In Luke's gospel, they're still having trouble believing, so he says, you got any fish to eat around here? He's just trying to give them a chance to take in. It really is him. So they go off in verse 24. This is why did the early Christians believe this crazy stuff? Well, why did the first disciple? They didn't believe it when Mary brought the message. She comes with the message, no response. Verse 24. Now, Thomas, also known as Didymus, which means twin. Thomas, also known as Didymus, he had a twin. One of the 12 was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we have this feeling that life conquers death. And we should believe an optimistic view about life. Right? No. We've seen the Lord. Right? It's news, not views. That's what they're saying. Thomas is actually the same as them. Thomas gets both bad press and too much good press at times. People don't read the story carefully. Thomas isn't going to believe. Look what he says. Unless I see the nail marks in the hands, they've obviously told him about that, unless I put my finger where the nails went and put my hand in the side where the spear went, I will not believe. Right? Thomas has had his heart broken once already. He thought Jesus was the Messiah. He'd left everything to follow Jesus. And the one thing that doesn't happen to Messiahs in the Jewish mind is they don't get crucified. Right? They crush the Romans. They don't get crushed by the Romans. So Thomas has had his heart broken. He is not going to be up for another set of illusions that's going to break his heart. He says, unless I get to see and I get to touch, I ain't believing nothing. Right? He knows what happens to dead people. You're a long time dead. And he's an empiricist. He wants to touch. He wants to see. And that's not wrong to want good evidence. What probably is a little dodgy is that he is saying, Peter, James, John, Thaddeus, all these guys, your senses, all 10 of you, are not worth one of my senses. We won't even bother with the chick, you know, with Mary. How could she be taken seriously? I'm not saying that, sorry. That's just, but that would have been the view in those days. So Thomas is sort of voting his own senses as being extremely superior and more reliable than everyone else's. That probably is not the way to go. That certainly is not the way science is based. If you know anything about the way science works, most of us have seen none of the evidence for most of the things science has proved. We always say, well, we could go, but we haven't. Most of what we know to be true about the world, we take on the fact that others have done the work, and we take their word for it. So then, as you know, Jesus turns up. It's beautiful in the next verse, it says that he waited, that verse 26, a week later his disciples were in the house again and Thomas was with them. Now this is where Jesus turns up. I love the fact Jesus keeps them waiting for a week. I don't know why he does that, but I find it fascinating. The disciples, they know he's risen and they've got their first opportunities to sort of practice passing on the good news, which they're going to be spending the rest of their life doing, and it's with a friend who's kind of impressed by Jesus already, and they have a week to argue the toss with him. And Jesus leaves them, and he leaves Thomas. I don't know why. I've got theories. That's all they are. But it's intriguing that he leaves him for a week, and Thomas is thinking, he's able to think, what if it was true? What if it isn't true? Why would I, you know, should I believe these guys? Should I only believe my own senses? Is that arrogant? Is that pride? Anyhow, a week later, Jesus turns up. And what he doesn't say to Thomas is, dear Thomas, you must learn to not trust your intellect. You must learn to cut your brain off when it comes to religious things and just believe. He doesn't. Look what he does. A week later, his disciples were in the house again and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he goes over to Thomas and says, put your finger here, see my hand, reach out, put your hand in my side, stop doubting but believe. Again, Jesus offers him evidence. Thomas, if that's what you need to convince you of the stuff that's true, here it is. Right? Jesus is quite happy with people being empiricists, that is, wanting appropriate evidence to believe crazy stuff, like the fact that death has finally met someone more powerful than it. And here's the interesting thing. Thomas's response, I've been pondering this week, it's a very strange response. Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. A more logical response would be, gosh, I was wrong. Turn to the boys and say, sorry. Or, oops. Or, hey, this is fantastic. But why does he go from seeing the risen Jesus to this extraordinary statement, not just the fact that he says, my Lord, but the second part is most shocking of all, and my God. Remembering that Thomas is a Jew. He's a monotheist. He's seen Jesus do a lot of stuff. He's heard Jesus make a lot of huge claims. But here's the point where he actually says, my God, and Jesus does not rebuke him. Right? If Jesus thought that was wrong, Jesus should slap him around the head, but he actually implicitly commends him. Because you've seen me, you believed. How blessed are those who haven't seen me and yet have believed. You know, if Thomas had sort of suddenly started to call a prophet God, you'd expect the prophet to slap him around the head at least, but it doesn't. I take it what's happened here for Thomas is, you know how they build arches? I've never seen anyone build an arch, but I've seen a few arches, some of them hundreds of years old. But they've got all these stone, but then there's one keystone at the top, isn't it, which is peculiarly shaped. And that's the thing that holds the whole arch together. And I think what's happened for Thomas is he's seen Jesus do calm the storm, which only God can do. He's seen Jesus make claims to be able to forgive sins, which only God can do. He's seen Jesus raise people from the dead, which only God can do, cleanse lepers, which only God can do. Say things like, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And then finally, though, when he sees Jesus having conquered death, that seems to be the keystone. and he goes, "My Lord and my God." It's the ultimate final piece in the puzzle that persuades Thomas that Christ is much more than a prophet, but is actually worthy of worship. And Jesus commends him for that. And then lastly, before I finish up, Jesus says, because you've seen me, you've believed. This is where you and I come into the picture. How blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed, come to believe. How can you do that? You weren't there. No, the next verse will tell you. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. The eyewitnesses wrote down what they saw. And you are only one generation away. John saw it. John wrote down what he saw. Right? The question is, you know, whether or not you want to be like Thomas and say, "No, no, unless I can see it," which is very difficult because you were born 2,000 years too late. The way that real time and space works is you've got to be at the right place in the right time. Thomas nearly missed it, whatever he was doing when they were all there that first night, but saw it. You and I simply 2,000 years too late. So what God has done is he's given us the record by honest eyewitnesses like John, who record the difficulties the disciples had and the benefits. So in the end, we're left with a choice. Josh McDowell, a professor, says this: "The resurrection is the most important and wonderful fact in history, or the cruelest hoax ever foisted upon the minds of humans." And I think a rational person like you needs to make your choice. Do you think this is the most wonderful thing that's ever happened, or just one of the cruelest lies that's ever been foisted upon humans?
Please be writing your investigative comments and questions for Ian to address.
There are three questions here. Why do Muslims think that Jesus was not crucified at all? That is, it was someone else who was crucified. Now, this is an interesting point, and I remember chatting with an Islamic lady who I became good friends with for a while, and she was an Islamic, well, she said she was an atheist, but she was sort of an Islamic atheist. It was one of those, no religion is true, but, you know, it was quite defensive Islam. And I said to her that the Quran says that Jesus didn't die. She said, "Rubbish," and it always looks a bit arrogant if you're arguing with someone about their own culture. I said, "No, it's in Surah 4. It's in chapter 4 if you want to find it. The Quran very clearly says that Jesus Christ didn't die. The passage mocks the Jews for thinking that they crucified Jesus. And their general teaching is that, I'm not sure if this explanation is in the Quran or not. It might be in the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet that go with it. The general view of Muslims is, that I've read and heard a number say, is that God did a miracle, that when Judas kissed Jesus, he made Judas look like Jesus and Jesus look like Judas, and Judas was crucified. And presumably Jesus didn't go and hang himself like the Bible says Judas did. So the reason why they say it is that it's an attempt to treat Jesus with respect and honor. Knowing how shameful crucifixion is in a way that most Westerners don't, they don't believe it's that God would let that happen to one of his prophets, particularly not to the second greatest of the prophets. I think at that point it just shows that the Quran doesn't get to first base, really, in understanding why Jesus came in the terms that Jesus says, where Jesus says in Mark 10, "I came to lay down my life." So if you could have rescued Jesus as he was being taken off to be nailed, and you would have ruined the whole plot. If you could have come down in, you know, some magnificent helicopter and plucked him out and some evacuate, you would have ruined, you know, it would have not been a good thing, according to Jesus. I hope that's a fair response to that. Is Thomas' response to have anything to do with Thomas receiving the Holy Spirit? He wasn't there when the other disciples were given that the Spirit was breathed on them. I don't think there's any particular connection between Thomas and the Holy Spirit in any way that I can see, but you can take that up with me afterwards if you'd like. Would Jesus be the first true women's liberation activist? That's a fair question, but I don't know. I don't know enough about world history to know if there weren't people before. There's an awful lot of mythology about women's liberation. I remember Simone de Beauvoir, one of the first of the great feminists in the recent era, because there have been a number of movements in the last 150 years. She said, and there's an awful lot of mythology, because she's a very keen feminist, but she said an awful lot of the talk about matriarchal tribes and that, said almost all of that is mythology. That, I said, much as she sought to find it, you'll have stories of difference, but she, as a scholar, went and looked at most of them and said most of them are wishful thinking. Was Jesus a person? It is clear that Jesus does something quite shocking when he chooses Mary. He doesn't tell us why, but that he chooses Mary. He could have chosen Peter. He didn't owe it to Mary. He could have chosen John. He could have chosen his mother. He doesn't. Mary Magdalene, who's a dodgy woman anyhow. She'd had evil spirits in her, so you either think she was mad or given over to evil at some stage, but Jesus chooses her. It is a beautiful statement, the fact that Jesus is not a sexist pig, as so often the church has been and is. Why does Jesus say, after giving evidence... Sorry, that's just because men do that in any culture. We've got bigger biceps, so we throw people around. Why does Jesus say, after giving evidence, it is better to have not seen and believed? I don't think Jesus says it's better to have not seen. He just says a special blessing on those who haven't. Because it's very likely you'll feel like, oh man, I would have so liked to have seen Jesus, wouldn't you? It would have been so much better to have been there, you know. And Jesus says, no. He especially says, don't panic if you don't get to see me, right? You're blessed. If that's where God has put you in time and space, the evidence remains good. And one more question has come up. I'm struggling to see the similarities between the God of the Old Testament and Jesus of the New Testament. They seem like different personalities. Your thoughts? That's a very, very common view, particularly in the last 100 years. And if you pick parts of the Old Testament and pick parts of the New Testament, you can paint a fairly stark contrast. My own feeling is that there are parts in the most ferocious parts in the Bible are in the New Testament, and many of the most beautiful pictures of the tenderheartedness of God are in the Old Testament. But there are things that God is recorded as doing in the Old Testament, such as particularly the nations of Palestine being removed so that Israel could come in, which are troubling. But I think what God is doing is dealing in great justice and mercy to remove those shocking cultures from the earth. The more, when I studied them at university, it was no great loss to human civilization that many of those cultures no longer exist. The way in which they treated human sacrifice, particularly babies. But we could talk about that further. I think if you read, just keep reading both rather than picking one or two, particularly that some will draw our attention to.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.